This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Good evening, I'm David Gale and welcome to The Informer. Tonight I'm joined by Paul McClure. On tonight's Informer, we will be chatting with Senator Janet Rice about the death of the plebiscite, then with Garrett Prestige from the Kirby Institute about the telling study, and finally to Sharon Matthews from Turning Point about some alarming statistics to do with alcohol-related ambulance attendances. The Turnbull government's proposed plebiscite on same-sex marriage has formally been killed off by the Senate, where it's defeated 29-33 in a late-night vote on Monday, amid a warning that the decision would delay marriage equality for years. In that vote too, there was one Liberal senator from Western Australia, openly gay, who actually abstained. So that's the best numbers that we can get. The Australian Greens have labelled the defeat of the plebiscite bill in the Senate as a win for common sense, equality and justice. Tonight on The Informer, we're just waiting for Senator Janet Rice of the Greens to come in. There were great celebrations last night in the Senate. There's a photo of Penny Wong high-fiving Murray Watt, both senators from the Labor Party, and of course of Senator Janet Rice embracing Sarah Hanson-Young and Larissa Waters. It was a very emotional victory. I suppose now, you know, we have to turn to think about who the enemy is. There's 29 that voted against. Certainly the Liberal senator from Western Australia who abstained is sort of having a foot in both camps. And of course, where are we going to go from here? Now, I actually had a chat with Rodney Croom, who's unavailable at the moment tonight, but he was up in Canberra. And of course, it was all to do with making sure that this plebiscite bill was defeated, and it has been defeated. So, you know, he said, look, you know, there was no way that he wouldn't possibly be in the Senate on the day that it was actually debated. And probably most people within the LGBTI community, certainly those that are active, they were certainly waiting for this bill to be defeated. Nobody actually counted their chickens before they were hatched. They wanted to make sure that absolutely that the bill was dead and buried, as one of our previous prime ministers used to say about certain things. So, of course, it has now been killed. And it looks like that we do have Senator Janet Rice just coming through on the line at the moment. Senator Janet Rice, welcome to The Informer.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Great to have you on again tonight. Look, I've done my little intro to you. I did mention that, you know, it was a rather emotional victory last night. I noticed that Penny Wong was high-fiving Murray Watt and that you were embracing Senators Sarah Hanson-Young and Larissa Waters as well. It was an emotional victory.
It sure was, and it was a really important moment, I think, in our long journey, somewhat bumpy journey towards achieving equality, and really was a victory for common sense, for equality and for human rights. And so now that we've got this ridiculous, wasteful, unnecessary, divisive, dangerous plebiscite out of the way, we can now move forward on achieving marriage equality as quickly as possible and letting Parliament do its job.
Look, the 33-29 vote, including as well as one abstention, who's the enemy now?
Look, I don't see it as a matter of people, anybody in the Parliament being the enemy. I think it's actually just bringing the people together across the Parliament who support marriage equality. We know that there are champions and silent supporters across the Parliament, right across the political spectrum. We know we've got the Prime Minister who supports marriage equality. We've got the opposition leader. I think if it came to having a free vote in the Parliament, we know that there would be overwhelming support for marriage equality across the Parliament. So it's a matter of just getting things to occur so that support can be realised and be translated into legislation. And of course, it's support that's building, because we know that there's majority support in the Australian community as well. When you've got 70% or more people in support of it, it's a pretty brave politician who says, no, we're not going to do it.
Yeah, well, we know about that, of course. At the same time, you know, we have those on the conservative side of politics saying, well, you know, we tried to get it through, we've done everything we can, so it looks like there won't be any marriage equality in this term of this parliament. So
yeah, well,
where do we go to from here?
Essentially, I mean, if you look at the level of the campaign that had been launched and organised and was successful in defeating the plebiscite last night, we haven't seen anything yet in terms of really continuing and ramping up that campaign, because people aren't going to go away. You know, the campaigners aren't going to say, oh, well, you know, we've defeated the plebiscite, now that we'll go and sit down and have a cup of tea. That level of campaigning is going to continue, and it's just inconceivable that we would have a Liberal Party going into the next election saying, nope, you know, we're going to continue to bind our members of Parliament to vote against marriage equality. If that's, you know, a surefire way of really hobbling themselves and ending up with being defeated at the next election. I just can't see it happening.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, I've heard from other community leaders within our GLBTI community saying, you haven't seen anything yet. And I suppose it is up to us all to keep pressure on our local members and to people inside the government. It will starve them eventually of oxygen to get their messages across. So I suppose that's
exactly
really what's going to happen.
Exactly. And I think, you know, in terms of the process, the next step is going to be, you know, we set out a three-step plan. The first was to break up with the plebiscite, and we achieved that last night. Step two is to get co-sponsored cross-party legislation introduced into the Senate, because even with the government's current position, there's a really good chance that we could get a marriage equality bill through the Senate. And that's so introducing it first of all, then when the votes are right, let's get it passed through the Senate. Then it will be sitting on the floor of the House of Representatives, and the pressure will really be on the Prime Minister and the Liberal Party to, you know, really stand up for equality, to stand up for human rights. And, you know, the Prime Minister in particular has got to show some leadership, and he's got to break free of the conservative right-wing members of his backbench who are currently holding him back.
Politics is a very long game. It is a pressure cooker down there. And thank you so much for taking time out to talk about this great victory last night. And we'll talk to you again very soon.
Indeed. And I really look forward to keeping on working with the campaigners, the advocates, but all the members of the LGBTI community and our families who are just, you know, we are determined that we're going to achieve equality in the end. We know that we're going to win.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you.
A lot is changing in the ways gay and bi men can protect themselves when they have sex with other guys. Discussing your HIV status with a sexual partner can be confronting for some men and easier for others. Do you tell your HIV status to your sexual partners? When do you tell them? How do you tell them? What happens after you disclose your HIV status? We want to know what works for you and what doesn't. The Telling Study is being run by the Kirby Institute at the University of New South Wales to ask gay and bi guys their thoughts and experience of HIV status disclosure. Tonight on The Informer, we are joined by Associate Professor Garrett Prestige from the Kirby Institute at the University of New South Wales. Hello, Garrett.
Hi there, how are you?
Look, great to have you on The Informer. Tell us, how did you come up with the idea for the study?
Well, this is part of the whole raft of activities that we're doing as part of a large evaluation of the changes that are taking place in HIV prevention and how they're impacting on the community over time. So it's really in response to the fact that in order to be able to respond to all of those changes, one of the really fundamental things is how gay men disclose or tell each other about their HIV status. Without that, nothing much else can really work.
Garrett, is this a follow-on from the Looking study, which was a study about how gay and bi guys find the right balance of pleasure and risk? I mean, are the two related in some way?
Yeah, they are. That was one of the first things that we were doing. And the primary purpose of that study was really to look at, for a long time, we've had the same ways of asking men about how they negotiate risk behaviour and how they negotiate sex with each other, with an eye to the risk. But because things have changed so dramatically, those questions actually didn't work anymore in the same way.
Right.
Couldn't tell us what we needed to know. So that the looking study was primarily about trying to help us to identify better ways of getting a handle on how men negotiate with each other in the current context.
Yeah, look, a lot's changing in the way gay and bi men can protect themselves when they have sex with other guys. I mean, many men still choose to use condoms to have safe sex, but other options are emerging, like PrEP, of course, and TASP, which is treatment as prevention. And they're changing the ways that guys think about sexual risk and the decisions that they make of that result. What sort of things do you want to find out from the study?
Well, as you said, this one is primarily about disclosure. So in this, what we're trying to do is get a handle on what men actually feel about telling each other about HIV status, but not just their HIV status, but about things such as TASP and PrEP. So are they telling each other about whether or not they're on PrEP, whether or not they're on treatment, what their viral load is if they're positive, those sorts of things, and what they're expecting from their partners in that regard as well. And it's not just about disclosure in person, but also about disclosure online, obviously, because that's a really important part of what happens these days.
Yeah, that's true, because there could be, there could obviously be some sort of stigma about disclosing, certainly online or on apps and things like that. So I suppose, you know, people might feel a bit discriminated if they do disclose, or not discriminated if they don't, I suppose. Is that the sort of thing we're looking into?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the stigma that's involved potentially on both sides of that equation, telling or not telling, and the expectations to tell or not to tell, all of those are the sorts of things that we actually really need to know. And while there have been some studies over the years that have addressed some of that, they haven't been for quite a long time, so things have changed. And B, they haven't been anywhere near as comprehensive and as much depth as this survey is investigating into those very specific things around how guys tell each other and what they expect from each other around telling.
Yeah, look, I did the telling survey a couple of days ago, and it asked gay and bi guys their thoughts and experiences of status disclosure. Do you want to tell our listeners what sort of questions are asked?
Well, there's quite a few. As with any of these kinds of surveys, we need to go into a fair bit of detail in order to be able to get the information that makes sense of what people are telling you. And so we ask questions about the circumstances in which they tell each other or that their partners tell them. So in a particular sexual occasion, what happened, who told who, and who expected to be told. But then there's also a whole set of questions about their expectations in general of gay men and what they think gay men should or should not be doing around these kinds of issues. And the standard questions, obviously, about their age and things like that.
How long would it take you to fill out, if I was to do the online study, how long would it take me? How long should I set aside to finish it?
Yeah, it varies enormously from person to person, of course, depending on how much I've done in the last
how quick you are on the computer, I suppose.
Yeah, but it's usually about 15 minutes or so.
Okay.
Massively long one, but
you're obviously trying to gather enough information. The information that is given by those who take the study, is that anonymous? Does that remain confidential?
Yeah, absolutely anonymous. We don't ask for any identifying details at all for this survey.
Tell us,
a simple cross-sectional survey, so yeah.
Who actually can participate in this survey?
Essentially, any gay or bisexual man living in Australia who's over the age of 16.
Okay. It's pretty wide open one. So obviously you want to get as big a cross-section as possible. Look, if you want to be a part of this survey, go to telling.org.au. We're going to provide a link to the site and the survey with our podcast soon after tonight's show. So that's telling.org.au. Look, it took me about 15 minutes. I really enjoyed doing the survey because it's also interesting to be able to look at yourself in respect as to what's going on as well in your own life as well. Thank you, Associate Professor Garrett Prestige from the Kirby Institute at the New South Wales University.
Thank you for your interest. Good night.
Thank you. Last week in The Age, on Cup Day, in fact, a celebratory day, there was a report about drunk men in their 40s and 50s dominating ambulance calls in Melbourne. The stereotypical image of young drunk men injuring themselves on King Street is being overtaken by a quieter epidemic of inebriated men in their 40s and 50s, new research suggests. Tonight on The Informer, we are joined by Sharon Matthews, a researcher with Turning Point in Victoria. Welcome, Sharon.
Hi.
Good to have you on the line. We had a little trouble getting you there, but, you know, this happens some nights. Look, firstly, can you tell us about Turning Point?
Sure. Turning Point has been around for quite a while. It was established back in 1994, and it provides a multifaceted sort of service. It offers treatment services, both face-to-face, online and telephone counselling services. Right. As well as an education sort of workforce development arm. So it educates the alcohol and drug sector, as well as providing graduate and postgraduate qualifications in addictions. And then there's the research arm. There's a population health research where I work, and there's also a clinical and a type of treatment services approach.
And it's part of Eastern Health.
We're multifaceted, yeah.
It's part of Eastern Health.
And we merged with Eastern Health back in 2009, so we're now part of a very large health service.
Okay, what got your interest up into this particular research?
Well, largely sort of as a reaction to a focus being on young people and young people's drinking, particularly young people's intoxication. And whilst that is incredibly important and sort of a valid issue, it had a feel that sort of the older groups, 40 plus, were becoming a type of hidden population. And in the sort of regular surveillance work we were doing with the ambulance project, we noticed over years that the average age for alcohol intoxication ambulance attendances was actually increasing ever so gradually. And so that prompted us to have a look.
It's interesting because that particular statistic, it was a bit of a surprise. I mean, normally the more newsworthy items, and I use that term loosely, are the ones, you know, with the younger people getting drunk and falling over and calling ambulances. And so this age group doesn't get a lot of airplay.
No, and a lot of that, I think, is largely around people just think because sort of this covers that baby boomer group. I said the 40s are a little younger than baby boomers, but they're an ever-growing, we're an ageing population, we're an ever-growing ageing group. And so I think a lot of it is dismissed because of that. But what we, our results show, we've adjusted for population. So this is over and above, this isn't about actual raw numbers. This is, you know, this is adjusted for that sort of ageing population effect, if you were.
Yeah, well, because the National Drug Strategy Household Survey has revealed a trend towards very heavy drinking among Australians in their 40s. In 2013, 9% of the people in their 40s reported drinking more than 20 drinks on at least one occasion, whereas in 2001 it was 6.4. So it is quite a significant, you know, 3% increase virtually of people reporting very heavy drinking on at least one occasion. What is the current guidelines for safe alcohol consumption?
The current guidelines at the moment is it's two standard drinks per day for low risk drinking, and so that's kind of sort of turning it on its head. But that they're currently being reviewed. But at the minute, it's low risk drinking is two or less per day.
I was just going to ask what a standard drink is, because I know a lot of people don't actually realise how much makes up a standard drink. If we're talking about spirits, for example.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's not straightforward. Nothing's ever straightforward, is it? But it all depends on, the strength of alcohol. Correct. And so, for example, let's see, a 30ml measure of a spirit at 40% alcohol is a standard drink.
Yeah.
A 60ml glass of sherry or port or a fortified, that's just under one standard drink. And 100ml of wine at, say, 12%, that is a standard drink. So a pot of full strength beer at around 5%, that's one standard drink. So it's not a lot.
No, it's not a lot. What is considered heavy drinking?
Oh, gosh, heavy drinking. Yeah. Well, in terms of, heavy episodic drinking, the standard measure is five or more standard drinks on one occasion.
Okay.
Okay, well, that clears it up for anybody that's listening at the moment. Look, these results, were they also replicated with call-outs to women?
No. So with women, the 40 to 49 and the 50 to 59-year-olds are lower rates than the 15 to 24-year-olds, so they still dominate in women. Trends are going up, so in terms of replicating results, yes, all rates are going up over time. But for women, the rates are much, much lower, and this particular mid-age group are lower than the 15 to 24-year-olds. They're tracking around the same as the 25 to 39-year-olds, but they're much lower. So it is different.
I don't know. I was joking with you the other day when I thought maybe the 15 to 24-year-old age group of women may have stiletto injuries or something like that. But it could also be, taking that a little bit further, it could be that maybe women in the 40s and 50s age group are not actually going out or not putting themselves at risk. Because obviously these men in their 40s and certainly in their 50s are putting themselves in enough risk factors in order to have an ambulance call for injuries. There's also things like other drugs involved, whether they be medical or not.
These results are actually, for as far as could be ascertained by the paramedics, these are just alcohol only, so no other drugs are on board. That's not to say that they're on their own regular medications and that's interacted. We haven't delved into that. And really the data that we use for this doesn't actually allow us. But by and large, there are no other drugs that they've consumed at the same time.
But, certainly men in their maybe 40s and 50s might be on, they could possibly be on antidepressants, they could be on blood medications blood pressure medications and things like that, and that might actually upset the balances and that they may end up, I don't mean just in balance, but upset the balances of their drugs as well as with the alcohol as well, and it could make adverse effects, I suppose. What about people in rural communities?
Yes. So in the sort of just looking at regional Victoria, and so we've defined that as just not Melbourne, and so again, rates have gone up, and for the 40 to 49 year olds, they're higher than the 15 to 24 year olds, and the 50 to 59 year olds in the last few years have been about the same as the 15 to 24 year olds, and then the older groups are, much lower. And it hasn't gone up as
rapid. This is for men, as it has in the city, but still, so a similar pattern, different rates, lower rates, but it's the 40 to 49 year old men and the 50 to 59 year olds are up there.
Okay. So the old excuse that, look, I'm just drinking high quality wines, I'm only drinking black label whiskies and things like that, does that mean that, I'd be drinking healthier because I'm drinking better quality and therefore, it's okay, this doesn't really apply to me?
Well, alcohol's alcohol, and so, a standard drink is a standard drink, so no, that's...
Okay, so it's just depend on how it really goes down, I suppose.
I mean, the only thing, there are changes as you age, there's changes in your metabolism and all that sort of stuff. And as you touched on with, taking your prescribed medications and stuff, they can interact. And also too, sadly, as we get older, we're at a higher risk of acquiring chronic conditions and such.
Sure.
And so they can also have an effect.
Okay. Look, there's a number of services for those that might fear that their alcohol or drug consumption is outside the normal range. Tonight we've been talking to researcher Sharon Matthews from Turning Point. If you'd like to contact Turning Point, you can by calling 1-800-888-236. That's 1-800-888-236. Or visit their website turningpoint.org.au. You can have a look at your risk factors. You can work out all sorts of things. Links will be with our podcast shortly after our show tonight.
Thanks for joining us, Sharon.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.